Hey, everybody, JJ Cooper, Jesus Cano, Baseball America Prospect Podcast. And today we are diving into some of the lesser seen aspects of the season. Jesus basically gets to see more good baseball, more significant baseball with fewer people at it than anyone pretty much I know. Well, Bill Mitchell for us also, I would say, checks that same box, our longtime Phoenix resident. But before we get into talking about instructional league, some of the names who stood out, some of the draftees, international names, no, and all that, you also went to something that is a little bit more seen recently. Just got back from the AAA National Championship game. And, you know, the key thing in a game like that is you want it to be memorable. And, man, that ended up being memorable, didn't it?
It did end up being memorable. I went to the AAA Championship last year, and off the top of my bat, I forget who won. This one is going to be a game that, you know, I will look back on it and just be like, man, do you remember that AAA National Championship? Yes, we did. I mean, just everything happening. The last two innings, you know, with Ryan Lavastida's, you know, go-ahead homer after the Aviators were down 5 runs and came back with the 7-6 lead. And then Jacob Berry with the walk-off home run, which, first of all, it was the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp walking off the Las Vegas Aviators at Las Vegas Ballpark. And that's because for the purposes of the game, they were the home team in Las Vegas was the away team. So that'll be maybe the only instance you might ever see that ever again. But it was a memorable game celebration after. Got a good story up and a lot of good video on our social media at Baseball America. We got both of those homers on our social. And yeah, I mean, just I'm hoping, I don't know what the official word is, but I'm hoping that game happens in Las Vegas again, because I try to find any excuse to go to that stadium, because that is just one of the, you know, I've been to not as many minor league stadiums as yourself or other people, but top notch. I mean, just a great place. And obviously Major League Baseball played there last year when the A's are there for 2 homestands. But yeah, it was such a fun experience. And really, they did a good job with the broadcast and just trying to grow the fan base a little bit more with minor league baseball, especially with such an important slate of Saturday games going on. Everything was well ran. And yeah, I mean, check out the coverage at baseballamerica.com. And it was a fun time, man.
So I was thinking back when you said that. I went to a few over the years, and I remember one in Columbus, Memphis 14, Durham 4. And one of the things I love about it, you look back at those games and, oh, who stood out? And it's like, oh, Randy Rosarena was 3-for-4 in that game with a pair of doubles. You know, Giovanni Gallegos, closed it out for Memphis. You had, you know, Jake Cronenworth, who we were watching earlier today as we recorded this for the Padres. Like, there's always guys who are like, oh, yeah, I remember Lane Thomas was in that game. There was a wide variety of guys. And that's kind of one of the cool things is you never know. You know some of them, and then you look back on it again later, and you're like, oh, I forgot that I also saw so-and-so. But that's, like I said, that was on TV. That was the public game for everyone. You've been spending a lot of times, and I want to say, when I say backfields, you know, backfields primarily, right, with the instructional league. So if you could kind of start this by, instructional league's been going on for a very long time, but it's kind of, I would say, changed over the years somewhat. It used to be a little bit more more games, more rigid than it is now. You're going to instructional league now. Kind of explain what instructional league's like in 2025.
Yeah, so instructional league, I think, is, you know, a little bit different than what it was in the past. I think before we explain what instructional league, it's important to explain what the bridge league and the continuation camp was, which, for all of our readers at Baseball America, you saw me, you read the stuff out there. Basically, what Bridge League Continuation Camp is essentially, you know, a mini league, you know, hence the word bridge, to help out a lot of the recently drafted guys and some ACL, FCL guys who did not get sent over to the next to affiliate ball right away, to just essentially bridge that gap into professional baseball, get that taste. Some players stay there the entire way. Some players get sent out to affiliates after a couple of games. So that's kind of what it is. And so Bridge League essentially sets up what instructional league is, right? So it starts really towards maybe the last week or so of minor league baseball regular season, where it's essentially, you know, for whoever finishes their season early and still want to get early looks, mainly for a lot of the lower level prospects, you know, your low A's, your high A's, you know, and some of your double A players, but also some of your international players who come over from the United States from the Dominican Summer League for the first time, and they're playing on these games primarily on the backfields. I think the Brewers have been the only team so far who have played games at the stadiums, and maybe here or there you'll get a game in Peoria, you'll get a game in Surprise. at those stadiums, but mainly they're on the backfields. And they're just essentially, you know, for these teams, these organizations, these player development to go on things and work on stuff that they saw from some of their players who either played a full season, maybe a couple of weeks of affiliate ball, and just incorporate a lot of the things that they saw there to the games back here in a low pressure environment, which is more of a, it feels sometimes more of a practice, right? Because there'll be situational ball involved. You know, of course, there'll be, you know, pitchers will go three or four batters within the inning to be able to get inning counts and stuff like that.
So you'll see this a lot of sometimes, I'll imagine. Yeah. Roll it. We're done. We're done with
and
this.
Roll now. It. Roll it is one of the best words you can hear, especially after the ACL where some of those innings went on forever. I mean, we're talking 20, 30 minute half innings. And sometimes you see these innings just rolling. It's like, okay, we're closer, one step closer. So that's what Bridge League and Instructional League is. And I think right now, I mean, some teams still have instructional league. I know the Angels had a late start. The Giants are going through it. There's going to be the Rockies and the Padres are playing a couple of games. So
the Reds still have one more week of at least instruction. I don't know how many games, but.
Yeah. And they had a pretty loaded lineup today from what I saw. Frodo Duno, Cam Collier, Neville, Kian Boo, and a couple of their other players were there. So it was a pretty stacked lineup. And it's like you mentioned, like, you know, they're these recently drafted guys playing on these backfields and, like, you know, outside of scouts and player development, there really isn't anybody else out there. So it's crazy the amount of access you have to be able to watch these guys play, you know, and it sets up a lot of them before the Arizona Fall League. And yeah, I mean, it's been a great experience. I've lived here in Arizona for 2 years before I was at MLB.com, but now working it specifically, you know, on the prospect side of things, I mean, this has unveiled like a different, you learn so much being back there, whether it's just conversations you hear within the players, you know, when they're talking about what to expect from a batter, what the coaches tell them as they're entering the dugout, or even what scouts have to say. Like, if you truly want to learn so much more baseball to the next level, you learn a lot of stuff at those backfields, the same way for me as a reporter, and definitely for the way the players who are transitioning into professional baseball are doing so.
So like you said, there's a lot of instruction to this. That's where I would say one of the things that I do think that has changed somewhat, and I think there's an intentionality to it. There's always been instruction. Like, there's always been some players are working on certain things and some players working on another. But it's become, I think, a little less formal. Like you said, there are still games, but there are some teams that are playing, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but are playing games against other opponents regularly, and others that are keeping it a little bit closer to home and kind of like, I know this is going on a good bit in Florida from what I've heard, is like where it's like the real focus is trying to make sure that they're, you know, whether it's today we're working on X, today we're working on Y, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah, no, for sure. Like, for example, the Brewers during Instructional League only played intra-squad games. They did not play anybody else, right? They just faced off against each other because it's the environment they wanted to be in. You know, you get situational, you know, positions for hitters, for defenses, and all that type of stuff to go to, too. But also, you see the same carousel of teams playing each other, right? Like, I know, you know, it's not Florida, right, where it's 3-4 hours away from each other. But a lot of the East Valley teams play the East Valley teams. A lot of the West Valley teams play the West Valley teams. And I think there's a good advantage to that because kind of when teams start to see each other playing a little bit more, it kind of makes that joint practice feeling a little bit, too. I was talking to a scout on the backfield not too long ago who was telling me, you know, when he was working for the Braves back in the day, you know, they'd have these type of joint practices at their respective facility, wherever they were, to kind of be able to do that. And he's seen a little bit of glimpse of that in Instructional League now with all these joint circles and pods and stuff like that are together too. So I think it's a great opportunity, obviously, for the players too, but I think more than anything, player development, to see a lot of these fresher, younger guys who are coming off after, you know, for some of them, their first professional season, it's the most competitive baseball they played all year, and incorporate that stuff before they send them off, you know, to the winter to, you know, recuperate, relax, rest, which is very important. Resting is very important. Getting the mental side of things is important, but have those things heading into the off season to be able to incorporate once they come back in early February back down here.
Okay, AJ, our slab pack ripping continues now. You just ripped a card that I think you're actually going to keep.
I am. I'm going to keep it. It's a Ken Griffey Jr. rookie card. The old, isn't this the famous Upper Deck one? I believe it is. And yeah, heck yeah, I'm going to keep it because I'm going to get Griffey to sign it. I'm going to get him to send it to me, which you can do, and I'm going to get Griffey to sign it, and it's only going to make it worth more. So I am all in on this card. I'm keeping it, and it is one of the coolest cards with the highest turtleneck you've ever seen and the gold chain around his neck.
graded 9, 1989 Upper Deck. You get the offer for 179. It's valued at around 199. And you're like, nah, I'm keeping it. But if you wanted to sell it back instantly, you can. It's the beauty of Arena Club. AJ is going to send in and get the physical card sent to him. And you could do the same. 20% off your first slab pack or card purchase can happen for you if you go to arenaclub.com/foul and use the code FOUL.
But the key thing that we know a lot of you all are listening and watching for is, okay, that's great. That's the basis of this. But let's talk about some of the players. And that's kind of one of the key things here, which is obviously a lot of these players, we did see them get snippets in the minor leagues this year. But a lot of some, in some cases it is this. But let's talk about some of the first rounders that you've seen out there. Let's start, you know, near the top of the draft. Ethan Holliday, I would say that his minor league debut was a little bit more strikeout prone than ideal, more swing and miss. I think that's going to be an off-season to-do item going into next year. You know, we've seen this with the Holidays in the past. We saw this with Jackson basically realizing he needed to make adjustments and then coming back the next year better because of it. Ethan's, I think, got some of that, you know, like in his off-season ahead of him as well. But what have you seen out there from Ethan Holliday?
All right, I'm going to take a timeout real quick because I'm going to put Zoe in the room real quick.
No problem.
Yeah, I mean, in regards to Ethan Holliday, I think you know what you said is kind of on the nose. I think one important thing to remember, especially more than anything for a lot of the high school baseball players who got drafted this year, is they've been working at it nonstop throughout the circuits, you know, and everything that comes with high school ball. And just a very big transition in their life that's going from graduating high school to immediately starting professional baseball. And I think you see a lot of fatigue within a lot of those high school players, to be specific, too, because it's the most amount of work they've ever done. And I think you kind of saw that in a couple of the debuts. If we're talking about Ethan Holliday specific, there was a big adjustment that comes with professional baseball, especially going all the way to low A, you know, right away, being involved in a playoff hunt with the Fresno Grizzlies and everything that comes to it. From the snippets that I was able to see him, though, is for one, much bigger than Jackson Holliday. I mean, he is, I would say, more physically developed than his older brother. And just looking at his swing, you know, early on, I got to see him for two games before he eventually got promoted to low A. And I think, you know, you can tell that he's a ball player and has a lot of good stuff going on for him, too. But more than anything, man, I think it's the swing. I think there's going to need to be adjustments with a lot of swing stuff going on. I think his swing might need to get shorter over time. And obviously, you know, the sample size is so small with everything that you've been able to see. But on the defensive side of the ball, he was able to hold his own with everything that was going on down there, man. I mean, granted, it was only 2 weeks, and I've actually gotten to see him a little bit now in the instructional league a little bit more. But I think for him, the important thing for him is that you see him holding on. You see him doing, which is what you want to see, you know, from the fourth overall pick and your first round pick for the Rockies, which, you know, is very important for them, given everything that's gone on with their farm system for the past couple of years. And, you know, as somebody who is doing the Rockies top 30 did the midseason update and doing the handbook season, it seems like this organization's kind of on the rise when it comes to stuff like that. But it's going to be the key thing that we've discussed year after year after year is once they get it to the majors, are we going to see the results? But I think there's a lot of things to be excited about when it comes to these players.
I'm going to be a little more cautious with them. I think that they need to do a better job of developing hitters. Charlie Condon had a okay year. But I would say the tough thing about that is that Charlie Condon's year looks worse when you compare it to, say, a Nick Kurtz, the other top college bats. And again, I'm not saying we don't expect every rookie to go out there, draftee to go out there and hit 36 homers in the majors within the year after the draft. That's an unrealistic. But Condon, like the power, again, he had wrist injuries and all this year. But we need to see more power next year. In Holliday's case, we saw it, you know, the swing and miss, the strikeouts are things that they were at an unsustainable rate this year. Mm-hmm. It was a small sample. It is something that you are hoping, you know, again, we root for prospects. You're hoping that next year he will improve that. But it is something where it is a little bit worrisome just from the standpoint of, like, those are things that you don't want to see, like, you're in your pro debut. When you, like I said, it instructs, are you seeing a little bit more contact? Because I know that, again, that was something we were seeing a little bit in Bridge League too.
Yeah, we are seeing a little bit more contact. I think the Rockies may be one of the teams I've seen the most since, and obviously that has to do with being my organization, but it's one of the teams I've seen the most. And I think there has been a different side of Holiday that I've seen since the one that got drafted, you know, straight out and was playing in the Bridge League right away. There has been a little bit more contact to it and a lot of deeper counts. I feel like whenever, especially taking video, I felt like I would only get maybe one or two good swings from Holiday, whether it was, you know, either a whiff or just making contact to stay alive. I think we're seeing him going a lot of deeper into counts and being a little bit more selective and a sense of urgency when it comes to getting deep into the counts. I think I certainly saw that throughout the couple games that I've seen at Instruct so far. And I'll get another look at him this upcoming Thursday because I plan on watching them against the Padres down here at Salt River Field.
Okay, so what about Billy Carlson? Another of these high school shortstop, you know, top of the draft picks. What have you seen from Billy between Bridge and Instructs?
Yeah, so the White Sox didn't have your traditional Instruct League. It was them, the Mariners, and the D-backs, and the Guardians, I want to say, that didn't have Instructs. But I got to see Billy Carlson, I mean, quite a lot at the beginning of the Bridge League as soon as it opened up. And I think the big thing for him, you know, is defense. I mean, the bat's there, but I want to talk about defensively as first. I mean, you look at his arm and you look at the way he's able to play the position. I think, you know, you mentioned, JJ, that there's a lot of good baseball play back here, but there's also a lot of bad baseball play back here with the defense, with base running. It's just stuff that you don't see in the majors, and that's a reason why they're in the majors. But a lot of these guys, you know, you see routine ground balls that should be easy slam dunk, you know, throw to first, and it turns into this whole thing where it extends the inning a lot more. I didn't see that with Carlson a lot. You know, I feel like he was really agile at the position and kind of moved out there. I wouldn't say close to a major leaguer, but definitely close to somebody who has quite a lot of experience playing professional baseball, you know, at shortstop. So on the defensive side, I think I was impressed with him as one of the better defensive players in the entire Bridge League. But the bat, I think there was a couple of times, you know, I went out to watch him and he'd draw walks, but there wouldn't be a hit. There was one day I had where he was able to drive three hits and it was through, you know, all over sides of the field and stuff like that. And talking to the White Sox farm director, Paul Yonish, I think that's one thing that he was really impressed about the most when me and him were watching Carlson going on at the same time, too. And I think one thing that really stands out, just because as a reporter, you're able to see the makeup a little bit more when you talk to these players, is the way he's so inquisitive about the game and just questions that he was consistently asking, you know, in the dugout to his manager, to his coaches, to his teammates, just about how to make that adjustment even better. And I think for the White Sox, especially in the state that they're given in with what's going on at the major league level, having your high school guy, your first round draft pick from this past year and hearing things like that from, you know, the farm director right away and seeing it firsthand is a really encouraging sign. Obviously Carlson didn't get assigned to a affiliate ball this year, and that was going to be the case for all of their recently high school players, at least from what Yonish told me, and we saw that in stuff like that. But I think it builds a good foundation for what they have this upcoming year. And the White Sox had a pretty interesting lineup every time I was out there. I think it was one of the more appealing lineups that they had, not just from the Carlson standpoint, but a lot of their draft picks, but also some of their ACL, DSL guys that came over that they were able to retain.
And keeping it in the first round, keeping it in first round high school shortstops. What about Steele Hall?
Yeah, so Steele Hall was actually the first, you know, draft pick that I got to see, you know, opening day at the Goodyear Complex for the Reds and the White Sox, where I saw Carlson too. And I mean, speed, man, speed, speed, speed. It's insanely quick. I think I was watching the game with Bill Mitchell down there, and we were just impressed how he was able to beat out a what looked like a routine, you know, infield hit, you know, with a 3.98, you know, speed to be able to get the first base. And we were all like, wow, that is insanely quick. That is insanely fast. But I think for what's it called, for Hall specifically, you know, I think his was similar to Carlson, a plus shortstop defender with fluid footwork, short area quickness, and a really strong arm. But when you look at the bat from a lot of scouts that I've been able to talk to, that there's a little bit of aggressiveness and there's a quick back, which is really good to see. Him take hacks and take a lot of swings in the zone, whether he makes contact or not, you want to be able to hit those balls in the zone. And I think against the pitching that he was able to face, that he was able to hold his own against them too. You know, I think there is more of a hit over power profile when it comes to him right now in the instance that I've seen him so far. But I think there is a lot of potential for him to grow. You know, you look at, I always forget, you know, as I'm learning through this evaluation side, that when you look at a guy's who are they right now? They're going to grow. They're going to add a couple of pounds of muscle down the road. And I think for Carlson, as he begins to develop a little bit more, I think we could see a little bit of a power spike up a little bit more. But overall, I mean, he was a really exciting player to watch. And he was always a player always in the lineup, whether it was batting leadoff, whether it was batting cleanup. It seemed like there was a lot of versatility for him being put out there whenever he was out playing for the Reds.
So we've gotten through some of the first rounders, but I think that maybe the most interesting guy that you got to see is one of the few, we could say, true two-way players who are still doing it in pro ball. And we'll get to that right after this quick break.
Getting the right people in the door quick is critical to maintain your company's workflow. When it comes to hiring, Indeed is all you need. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed Sponsored Jobs helps you stand out and hire fast. With Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, Sponsored Jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it makes hiring so fast because it puts the best and most qualified candidates in front of you quickly. Plus, with Indeed Sponsored Jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. How fast is Indeed? In the minute I've been talking to you, 23 hires were made on Indeed, according to Indeed data worldwide. There's no need to wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
And we're back. So, Jesus, okay, I got to ask you, Josh Owens, we see this every now and then, right? Okay, Shohei Ohtani is the guy. He's the two-way star. But is there anyone else out there who can at least give it a run? Not to be Shohei Ohtani, but to be plausible as both on the mound and as a hitter.
You know, I think there's two players in the instructional league that I saw going on, but we're going to talk about Josh Owens right now, because I think if there were to be a standout player award given out within the Bridge League instructional league, I think it has to be Josh Owens. You know, he wasn't even their first round pick, but he was the guy that stood out in count. You know, when I talked to scouts, there'd be a lot of scouts who would tell me, you need to go out to Surprise to watch Owens play. And I got to see him as a hitter to begin with. And I think that, you know, he was one of the more impressive hitters in the lineup. I mean, you look at his advanced tool set, he shows a lot of gap-to-gap power, has a lot of natural barrel control, and an advanced feel for the strike zone from what I was able to see. And I got to see him earlier, too, during the draft combine here at Chase Field with Carlos Collazo and Bill Mitchell, and we were watching his batting practice, and he was ripping up exit velocities as high up as 180 miles per hour. And I think he is a very developed hitter, obviously high school hitter has a lot more work to do, but I think the polish was there to go. And then I got to see him pitch for the first time a week ago. And granted, it was just an inning. I think it was just three batters. But I think you look at the way he's able to do, he kind of has a little bit of a sidearm delivery. You know, he doesn't have your traditional three-quarter slot or anything like that. And he was able to move through hitters. I mean, he had his fastball was sitting in the mid-90s with arm side life. And I also got to see him pull out his sharp slider a couple of times, you know. And I think he was really impressive. And in talking to a lot of different scouts too, when I'm asking, do you guys think he genuinely has the potential to be a two-way player? Because you see a lot of teams, you know, taking the gamble, and a lot of these high school or international guys that come in as two-way players take the gamble maybe after a year or so, you know, they give up on them. But in talking to scouts, a lot of them think that Josh Owens has the potential to have a pretty deep run, you know, as a two-way player. You know, maybe on not the level as like Shohei Ohtani, right? Because that's a unicorn.
That's
one of a kind, right? But as somebody who could be effective, you know, I don't think we haven't seen anybody that's been a two-way player that can play at the highest level possible. But a lot of people are you know, there's a lot of helium when it comes to Josh Owens, right? And he went up to low A this past season, and he, you know, did it both ways. He hit and he pitched there too. So I think it's a lot of encouragement right there too when it comes to Josh Owens. I think, like I mentioned, he was a big camp standout, and, you know, look forward to see what he can do in the first year of professional baseball.
I would say with him, like the thing that we'll watch, because you said we do see multiple guys who they dabble, right? They start out their career doing it. And it's just really hard. The next step is, to me, a lot of times where it becomes much harder. You know, like when you're in the complex, you can kind of divide up the season and it's a little easier, but then you get to, you know, I would say that what you kind of get to that point where you say, okay, now how are you going to pitch? Like you almost become a DH right away if you're going to do it. Like we saw this with Mason Wynn. Mason Wynn arrived as a two-way player. He was going to pitch and he was going to play shortstop, but he ended up playing shortstop because it's really hard to play shortstop and pitch. Mm-hmm. We have guys like Chang Lin with the Reds, like is a guy who last year was primarily a hitter, outfielder, third baseman. This year is primarily a pitcher, and it looks like that's maybe his path long term. Now, it's just hard to figure out how you're going to divvy everything up, but let's see if Josh Owens can do it. Okay, these other guys we're going to talk about that also stood out are not guys who we have to worry about that. Cruz Schoolcraft, I know you've seen him hit in high school. We don't have to worry about that anymore. He's a pitcher. But what have you seen from Schoolcraft?
So, yeah, I think it's important for me, you know, as I go through this for the first time, I got to see Cruz Schoolcraft play in a big prep tournament going down here in Arizona. I got to see him down in Chandler. And that was my initial view at him, man. Granted, it was just a couple of innings, but he was really struggling with command, you know, in that inning. You know, there was a lot of balls in the dirt, a lot of balls outside. And the team he was playing wasn't necessarily too competitive, but they were able to get hits off of him left and right. And seeing, you know, him in his not professional debut, but seeing him in his Bridge League Instructional League debut, there was a lot of hype around him when being able to watch him play. You know, I wrote a story about him earlier in the season about what he was able to do just immediately after the outing, sought advice from veteran scout Ron Rizzi about his pro debut. And you look at him, and a guy that I see a lot in Cruz Schoolcraft, and something that I talk to with a lot of their scouts too when I come up with my own comp, just to make sure that I'm not just out of the ordinary, but I see a lot of AJ Puck in him. Obviously a guy who at one point as a prepster was a two-way player, solidified himself as a starter at Florida, and now, you know, more of a reliever that could turn into a closer now on the shelf with the Diamondbacks. But there's a lot of that similar profile in him too. The fastball was heavy, was high, you know, 97, 99 miles per hour in the start that I was able to see him play. He's made two starts since then. And he also flashed out his changeup. The one thing I didn't get to see was his slider, which was a pitch that I saw when he made his high school start earlier in the year. And that was kind of a pitch that I wanted to see where it was. But in talking to different scouts and stuff like that, there was just no reason to throw that slider when he was facing a bunch of right-handed hitters. It just wasn't allowed for the situation of ball. So it's not like they're hiding it or they're waiting to work on that. It was in the situation going on too. So, I mean, it was really encouraging to see. I think a lot of people within the Padres organization that I've talked to were very surprised and were very excited that they were able to land him there. And eventually he spent, I think, an inning or two in low A Lake Elsinore to be able to pitch for them. But it sounds like the plan for him next year is to start at that level next year. And for a Padres system that absolutely depleted their farm system for all the trade deadline moves that they were able to make, I think it's a really encouraging sign to see what Cruz Schoolcraft was able to pull out this year. And I think heading into the upcoming season, you know, there's still, you know, things to work on, obviously, with any pitcher and stuff like that. But I think there's a lot of really good, better things coming out of his first start compared to bad things.
So what about, you've already talked a little bit about the White Sox, but what about Jaden Foskey, their second rounder? He was another guy, seemed like he was one of the standouts that you saw.
Yeah, and, you know, just like I was talking to Paul Janish about him, right? The big thing that he thought about him is he was the guy from day one to start taking that leadership role a little bit more among the new draftees. And that was just something that stood out to them right away because it confirmed everything that they saw in their makeup and stuff like that. When looking at Foskey, I think he was a really good get for the White Sox in the location that they were in. You know, a polished left-handed bat, smooth, really good swing with excellent play coverage and a high contact rate from what I was able to see in the, you know, couple of games at the beginning, and a really good feel for the zone, which you don't see a lot in a lot of high school players, but he had a really good feel for the zone and growing into his body. But he did show a little bit of plus power. I didn't see him hit any home runs, but I did see a couple of balls who, you know, if they were played in a couple other major league parks, would have left there. And I think for a high school player to see that power come up for him in the slot that he was taking was very impressive. I think, you know, also defensively too, like I really liked what I saw from him too. You know, I think while, you know, he used to be a below average runner, I saw a little bit of speed for him to come out in center field. I think that was like one question that was looming as I was doing my research heading into the Bridge League Instructional League. But from what I saw right out there, the base running was great. The defense was great. And there's a lot of poise in him from a lot of people, you know, from Paul Yonish to be specifically within the White Sox organization, that's seen a lot of good results on him. And I would say, you know, is he a camp standout for the White Sox? Potentially, I think him and Billy Carlson will both up there too. But to have a high school guy that you signed for and stuff like that, especially because he still has room to grow into plus raw power, like a 20 to 25 homer range, I think the results are very encouraging.
So, but probably even the guys I'm more interested to hear about is, for some guys, this is their first chance to come over to the States from the DSL, from mm-hmm. signing internationally, a lot of cases playing the DSL, and then come over and kind of get their feet wet in Arizona, that's prepping them really for going into next year. And that's where you get, I mean, you're getting your first eyes on these guys too. You have an advantage over me in that, you know, there are guys that you can converse with much more easily than I can, because my Espanol is terrible. But we got to start with, okay, I'll let you tee it up, but I know which way you're going to go. Who stood out to you?
Guy right away, Josuar Gonzalez from the Giants. I mean, there's, you know, I think it's very, I've only been here for, I mean, close to a year now, but how rare is it to have a guy who's only played DSL in the top 100? I mean, is that something pretty rare to happen?
Yeah, a couple of times, but not often.
And
Vladimir Guerrero Jr. did it.
And I remember vividly the day that I was sitting at this desk behind me. I was doing work thinking, I was like, oh, let me take a day off. And then I get a text message from a scout saying, hey, Joe Swartz in the lineup for the Giants in Tempe, which is 5 minutes away from where I live. And it was like 9:20. And it was like 10:20. The game started at 11. And I packed everything I could and headed down there.
Because if I remember correctly how that day went, you were already like, wait, there was someone playing for the Brewers. And you were like, I could go check out that. And then we heard Josuar, and it's like, nope, Josuar, there we go.
Yes, exactly. That's what was happening. And it's, right away, he got two hits that day, and you just see it. And it was just like, he made that transition look so smooth, so easily against the Angels pitchers that they had right there. And it was just kind of, I mean, I didn't expect it to happen. I didn't expect him to be there, right? And then just be able to see play, because you see the video, right? You see what Josh Norris writes. You see you hear the conversations you have with him, but seeing them, it's like, wow, like contact. Like I don't know how many times he whiffed when he was playing out there. It seemed like no matter what it was, you know, he had contact every single step of the way. And also the speed. Oh my God. It's, you know, it's crazy that the moment he got on the base paths, how much attention would be brought onto him from the pitcher, from the battery, you know, it's to see him go and steal a bunch of bases too. And see the work at defense at shortstop too. Like he is everything that, you know, I had hoped for. And it's, you know, at just, you know, his age, I think it's either 17 or 18 years old. There's a lot more
17,
stuff.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Like there's a lot more stuff to come through. And the other thing too, one thing to point out, JJ, is I got to see him a second time against the A's. And in that game, inside the park homer, opposite field homer.
And if you're watching this on YouTube, you're watching those because, you know, you were there, you got video of them. But yeah like, I mean, when you're talking about play days you dream of, is like, hey, I'm going to go see one of the best young prospects in the game. I hope he does something today. No, he didn't do something. He did two different spectacular things. The body, the feel, the maturity, you know, it just a lot of boxes are checked there. But I would also say a little bit of a tougher evaluation, but a very interesting one is Edgar Montero. Now, in Josh Warr's case, he was the guy who was a big money dude, was a very prominent signing, you know, January, part of the January class, goes to the DSL, and it's like, oh, no, no, no. We thought he was here, which was already very high, and he took a step further than that. In Montero's case, he's kind of something we're seeing more of now, which is the last year he was a DSL guy. This year he was a DSL guy, second-year DSL, and everything really emerged this year. So then he comes to the States having kind of in his second try of the DSL. 10 years ago, that would have been like, second year in the DSL. But now, with how it works with the 165, and the minute you set foot in the States, you are counting as one of the roster, you know, the roster, the major league roster limits for the minor leagues. It's something where teams are a little bit more hesitant to push guys until they're really ready. When you saw him, it looks like Edgar Montero is ready now for the States.
No, yeah, I mean, he's definitely ready. The one thing I will say is that the A's were a little bit more conservative with him. He wasn't playing in games. You know, Josar was playing in games every day. Every time there was a game, he was in the lineup. I would say Montero was playing maybe once, maybe twice a week. That would be pushing it. Everything else would either be intra-squad work or just work on the field and stuff like that, just because the A's are a little bit more cautious, especially given the track record of the international signings in the past. Now that they've been able to find Edgar Montero and the way he's been able to play and produce so far, you know, and I've actually, you know, with Joe Suarez too, but I actually got to speak to Edgar Montero and I got to speak to him in Spanish, which, you know, it's always great to see that sign of relief from him when he's able to talk to somebody in his native tongue. But also too, I mean, for him just being 18 years old, I mean, that's there's a lot of maturity on this. You know, that's one thing I really truly admire about a lot of the international players that come and make that change, you know, just maybe going a little bit off topic, but I think it's important to talk about this, JJ, that these players are coming into a whole different world when they come over here. You know, I mean,
yeah,
18 was a lot closer to me than it is for you, but you can us remember being at 18, right? And just how
Going off to college was a big deal. And that was going like, I'm going a few hours away from home and everyone speaks the same language that I do. And it's really not that much different than what it was. Mm-hmm. That's different from I'm going literally a long plane flight from home. I'm in a different culture, a different country, speaking a different language that eats different food, that, you know, like all those aspects. But I do want you, because you've done some reporting on this too, stuff up at Baseball America. Yeah. The key thing with that, I think that where teams are doing a much better job. I remember a conversation I had 10 years ago, probably now, at Rays camp one day, and I was talking to one of their their top front office officials who worked in the international market, and we were also talking to one of the guys who kind of been there from the beginning of when teams started going into Venezuela, when teams started making more of an effort in the Dominican, and he was talking about how back then it really was kind of almost like just the way they treated it was you rolled out the baseballs and it was survival of the fittest. And even like when I was covering, you know, minor league baseball in the 90s, and it really was something where their teams were starting to do a little better job, but it really wasn't. There was not a whole lot of helping prepare, helping, you know, mm-hmm. kind of set the stage for players to succeed. What you're seeing now, still a big jump, still a big hurdle, but when these players are coming over for the first time to the States, it does feel like now it's kind of their teams are trying to make sure that there are situations there with, you know, in some cases, like, you know, English language classes to help basically players acclimate with a dormitory type setting where you're here, but you're also not just kind of set off to like at your own devices. It's a little bit more programmed, a little bit more kind of under team control. But what are you, again, you're there, you're seeing it. What are you seeing?
There's a lot more support for sure. You know, and the story that I wrote about how complexes are helping a lot of these players adapt to it. You know, I talked to Angel Reyes, who was a, who now works as a real estate agent, but is continuously, you know, working and helping people within the complexes, help their players adapt. But he was somebody who was in the Rockies system, came over from the DR, and it was in a much different state and time. You know, they weren't paying for housing. They weren't providing for housing. They weren't providing transportation, I believe. And now, you know, in talking to him and how everything's changed, it's almost been day and night, you know, like it's, I'm pretty sure, at least on the Cactus League side, you know, not so much on the Grapefruit League side, just because mm-hmm. this is my home area. There is at least a life skills coordinator at every facility that helps a lot of these athletes go through that. It helps a lot of these international guys, not just in talking to the, you know, the Latin American, the Caribbean guys, but also, you know, a lot of the ones who
Korean
come from Asia too.
Yeah.
Japan. They spend a lot of time, you know, just teaching them how to do simple things, JJ, like stuff in that you and I probably take for granted, like how to use a washing machine, how to order an Uber, how to order at a restaurant, right? This is stuff like that. I've
known players before who, you know, the story was, is like, I ordered the same thing over and over because I learned how to say, you know, fried chicken or chicken with rice or pizza or whatever. And it was like, that was where you're going to eat every night because I knew I had that word. Yeah. I remember when I was covering the Macon Braves that there was the clubby would go out with a pickup truck and pick up like seven players who didn't have transportation and all in the back of a pickup truck coming in every day, you know, like that was the transportation. And I'm talking, there were multiple future major leaguers who were in the back of a truck, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, again, I'm not talking with a cab, like just kind of sitting in the back of a truck. And that was just like, yeah, this is how we do this. Nowadays, again, there has thankfully been improvements on this.
Yeah, but there's been proper transportation added. I mean, there's housing, right? And it's paid by huge. The game. That's the biggest thing, right? Sure, like you look at teams like in surprise, right? The Royals and the Rangers have their, you know, their dormitory, and it's quite the sight to see and stuff like that. The Reds started incorporate that. The Guardians have something like that. Other teams are trying to find ways to do that, but if not, they're finding actual apartment complexes where players can congregate and be together instead of each having them in their own individual hotel room and just, you know, when they get home, it's just that silence that comes with it, that thinking, those nights, those thoughts that you have in your head. Instead, you're building a community. And I truly think that now with those international players and speaking to a lot of them and a lot of guys who made it up the ranks a little bit more, it gives them that comfortability to, you know, feel a little bit at home, make it as much the home as possible, being around familiar environments and having people who genuinely want to help you outside of baseball and prepare for you in case, you know, because the reality is a lot of these guys aren't going to make it out the complex. So very few are going to be able to make it all the way to the highest level possible, like Juan Soto, like Ellie De La Cruz, right? But a lot of them need to prepare for life after baseball. And I think they're doing a good job doing that. And in turn, so, you know, all to bring it, circle it back together to what we were talking about is you see that comfortability a lot in these players. You see it in Joe Suárez, you see it in Edgar, and you see it in all the other guys who spent their first year in the ACL. And I think that's a really important topic. And I think, you know, I see it in talking to a lot of these players now. It's important to have those conversations with them in Spanish to let them know, hey, I'm a reporter. I'm a Latino reporter. I can speak Spanish. You know, I want to tell your story. I want to hear about you more. And I think it really creates that. So good opportunity to bring that just because it's you see the finished product, right? You see Juan Soto, you see Ellie De La Cruz, you see these guys, but you don't see when they first arrive and everything mm-hmm. they have to go through.
And that, speaking of, one more of that, which a player who comes from, when we talk about a lineage of players. So you could say with Gabriel Davalillo, you could say like, well, his brother, by the way, you may recognize that Davalillo name because his brother is one of the better pitchers in the Rangers organization, David Davalillo. Mm-hmm. But then really you should be saying, wait a second, I remember that name because his grandfather, Vic Davalillo, was a long time successful big leaguer for many years. Uncles, father, played pro ball, all that. But I would say that, like, if you're looking at Angels prospects and you talk about hitters, pure hitting ability, ceilings, all that, Gabriel is one that really does jump out as a guy who the tools are there. Now, he's big for a catcher right now. Like, that's going to be something to watch. But as a hitter, he really does jump out when you watch him swing, right?
Yeah, that's actually the only player I haven't seen play on this list, but I think it's important to mention that just because, you know, a lot of our subscribers and just sure if you're listening to this podcast, you were wondering who the, you know, that's the great thing about this podcast is I know these people who listen to it. Thank you guys. You guys want to hear about this stuff. That's the one player I haven't seen play it, but I think it's important to mention because you mentioned the lineage and you also mentioned, you know, the state of the Angels. The Angels farm system hasn't been the strongest, you know, in, you know, their own respective whatever. But the lower level seems to start taking a turn a little bit more. You know, the low A, the well, their former low A affiliate at Inland Empire, you know, had a good season. The ACL Angels won their first ever ACL title. And, you know, now we're starting to see a lot of their international guys, not just, you know, Davalio, but also I think Hayden Alberts was also another guy that stood out there. But we're just seeing this, and that's a guy, you know, Davalio is going to be a guy that I'm going to go out and watch, and we'll get video, we'll post it on baseballamerica.com. But I think it was an important name to mention here in talking about prospects who have made their ascension over here to the stateside and stuff like that, just because he did well in the Dominican Summer League. You know, he was a guy that I think Josh Norris had mentioned a couple of times too. And I look forward to seeing him play whenever I get him because the Angels, 2 more weeks of instructional league from them, which is nice. It bleeds into the Arizona Fall League. So it means I can double up at some point. It also means Josh Norris may double up or triple up on some games.
Oh, I promise you he will. He's counting the days until the start of the Arizona Fall League. I may enjoy things, but I don't know if I enjoy anything like he enjoys the Arizona Fall League. And I know that you're looking forward to it, you know, a whole lot as well.
Yeah.
But, well, that leads us to the thing we always wrap this up with, which is our prospect soapboxes. As we know, as you know, Jesus, but if you're listening for the first time, we do this every week. And what we want to do is we want to highlight someone who's not a top 100 prospect, right? So the rule of this, simple enough, is if you're in the top 100, we're not talking about for this. We already are giving plenty of reason to pay attention there. So with that, who is your prospect soapbox?
Yeah, so when you mentioned this to me, I think right away I had my guy right away, and that is Luis De La Torre from the Giants organization, who played in the Arizona Complex League this past year and made it up to low A San Jose and was just dominant at every single level. And, you know, when we talk about baseball and pitching to be specific, right, now we're just seeing a bit of an increase when it comes to speed, right? We're seeing, you know, to have a not necessarily have success, but it's more common to see young pitchers top, you know, 96, 98 more frequently than we used to back in the day. Me making it sound like I was there back in the day. But the good thing of I think what makes De La Torre such an interesting prospect is he has that speed, but he also has deception, which is starting to become the new trend that I think we're seeing in a lot of pitchers and how they descended. You know, a left-handed pitcher who is 21 years old, might have, you know, be 22 last time I checked, but he was 21 when I did a story about him. And you talk about a guy who has interesting journeys. I mean, the Giants have a lot of guys who do that too, but De La Torre wasn't a guy who was an international signee, you know, from Mexico or anything like that. You know, he was born in Mexico, raised there, and then moved to the United States and Utah to just go to school. They had a baseball team. He tried out. COVID shut that down. And then he was just playing some adult rec league. And somebody said, hey, you throw pretty fast. You're pretty good. Maybe you should try playing baseball professionally. He took the gamble, went over to the Dominican Republic and trained there. And eventually was able to get signed out there for $10,000 and going from this unknown name who I don't believe was on our top 30 to begin the year. And now he's somewhere in the middle of the pack. And, you know, Josh Norris. And
he'll keep going up.
And he's going to keep going up. And he's a little bit on the older side, you know, for low A. I think he's a guy who could ascend his way up. There's a guy who has had a lot of helium. You know, Ballingy Group signed him and snagged him right away because they saw a lot of potential in him. And I think that there is a lot of potential. I think at the beginning for me, my question was, does he have the potential to be a starter in the majors? And I think that was answered when he went up to low A and just dominated every single step of the way and was going deep into games. It seemed like he was a recurring character in our hot sheet, you know. And I think whether the Giants, where they want to put him next year, start him up in high A, but I could see him starting up in low A too, you know, with the way just how players, you know, ascend a little bit through the farm system more. But that is going to be a guy that I think a lot of people need to keep up. And I just think about how fortunate I was to be able to see Luis De La Torre, Argenis Cayama, and Kiner Martinez all in the same starting rotation, and they eventually made their way up to low A. I have, you know, I'm from originally from the San Francisco Bay Area in the East Bay, and I have a lot of friends who are Giants fans, and I told them multiple times, you guys need to get down to San Jose to watch these, you know, San Jose Giants, because the pitching's electric, the lineup was really good, and I think for the low end for the Giants system, there's a lot of good stuff going on, but Luis De La Torre, to me, is a guy that's going to break out next year.
So mine, I'm going to go one. This one, I got to be honest, this one's a little bit more straightforward than I like to do a lot of times. But I'm going with the Twins, Merrick Houston, because I can't not, because we did a little project here we've been working on, which is I've been pulling the best plays for every prominent shortstop. I think I'm going to keep adding to it. But like I believe right now I'm looking at it and probably 25 minor league shortstops right now. Because it's really useful. Like when we say best plays, you're kind of like doing the extra effort plays, right? I'm not saying this is a full, like every play that every shortstop made in the minors this year or anything like that. But you are looking for plays like, okay, can he go in the hole? Can he go to his left? How's the arm look? Like the plays that really are stressing the shortstop. And of all the shortstops that we've looked at, and I mean, I've looked at, again, every one that you can think of. Mate, DeVries, you know, obviously Connor Griffin, who's, by the way, really good. But first rounders from this year, if they made it to full season ball, all this. But thank you, Synergy Sports, for to have the video that allows us to do this. The one who jumps out the most, and I really would say it's not that close, is Merrick Houston. The first rounder from Wake Forest. He was known as a great defender going in the draft. He's really good. Like, when I talk about in pro ball, he's at Cedar Rapids, I think, primarily. But you every now and then you see those plays where you're like, okay, you kind of see everything you want to see. And there were a couple of those, really especially to his left, where he was going well past second base, making the play. One where he's like on his knees and still has enough in his arm to get a good throw off and get the out. Another, which maybe kind of showed me that internal clock that you're looking for, where he goes to his left. He's really hurrying because he's gone a long way to get to this ball. And then he kind of clocks that, oh, slow runner. And you could see him just relax and slow down, makes the play. Like there's no reason to put all that on it or anything like that. Don't need to on this play. And so that kind of headiness, ability to go into the hole, the ability to go to his left, the body control, the ability to go to the ground and then get right back up very smoothly, cleanly, quickly, which is something, you know, that some players like Luis Peña is really good prospect. You watch him go to the ground. It's not nearly as fluid. It's not near as easy. You see why some of that, why he might end up at second or third base down the road because that kind of stuff. But Merrick Houston, we'll see how good the bat is. I don't really have any worry about whether this guy, like if you told me right now, and I'm not saying they should do this, but if you said, who is the Twins' best shortstop defensively in spring training next year, unless they go out and sign somebody, it's going to be Merrick Houston because that guy's that good defensively. It just really just jumps out when you watch him. So that's my prospect soapbox for this week. Jesus, you got a busy week ahead again because it doesn't really slow down now. You've got, you know, the end of instructs, but we've got Arizona Fall League Media Day on Friday, which you'll be going to. And then it's here. Arizona Fall League opening day. By the time we record our next podcast, we'll have games, right? So
we will. We will. No, it's, it's been whirlwind for sure. I mean, it feels like I celebrated spring training opening day, extended opening day, ACL opening day, Bridge League opening day, Instruct League opening day, and now this is what, sixth unofficial opening
day? Last one really of the year, right? Like this is your last opening day. And actually, we conversation that we had in person, you know, in spring training was like, I know it's been slow. It's going to be a fire hose soon, and then you'll really enjoy the slow. The slow is at least, the slow is coming again now. Like, you know, we get to November, there's not that much going on in Arizona. Even though the funny thing is, it's probably be the coolest and most comfortable time of the year.
But yeah. I do want to say before we sign out real quick, though, that I think, for all our Baseball America subscribers who see this, you know, there has been an influx of Arizona coverage, and that's, as we mentioned, I'm based out of here full time. Yes, before anybody asks, yes, the summer sucked, but we got to do it, right? That's what it is. But I, you know, I want to thank them because I think, you know, this is the first time, you know, really there's been any coverage of the Bridge League and Instructional League in the way that it's been presented so far. And when I joined Baseball America and we had that conversation, you know, crazy around this time last year, JJ, of stuff that I wanted to do, I talked about how much I really wanted to go out and cover the Bridge League and the Instructional League out here, because it's just a lot of stuff that you don't know about. And you look back at last year, Nick Kurtz was playing in the Bridge League, Jack Caglione was playing in the Bridge League, and a lot of other players are playing in the Bridge League, and they've made their way down here to the majors now. Nick Kurtz is a, you know, Baseball America Rookie of the Year, should be the AL Rookie of the Year too. You know, and this was year one for me. There's a lot that I learned, a lot that, you know, that I enjoyed. And heading into next year, you know, there's a lot that I want to get done after now going through it, going through the rhythm of talking to scouts, evaluating players, watching games on the backfields, and the coverage is only going to get better next year. So if you're a Baseball America subscriber, look forward to that next year. If you aren't a Baseball America subscriber, there's another reason to subscribe. It's stuff you won't find, you know, anywhere with the extensive coverage that we do. I just want to thank everybody for that because it's been really fun covering this. But we still have the Fall League. We're going to get coverage of that. So it just keeps on going down here in the desert.
It keeps on going, and we'll have it. And we're going to wrap this up because we are in the, I believe, seventh inning of Yankees-Red Sox. If you see me kind of on the screen looking over every now and then, sorry, guys, but we're, you know, we're playoff baseball. We're trying to do both. We're trying to multitask here. It's been a fun day already with all that. For Jesus, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.